Let's go now from new technology to a classic brand trying to stay relevant. The American photography pioneer Kodak is also struggling just to survive. The company is being dogged by bankruptcy rumors. Its stock has tumbled to less than a dollar. Kodak is still sounding optimistic, at least in public. It expects strong fourth quarter earnings. Zach Seward from the Innovation Trail Reporting Project in upstate New York sent us this story from Kodak's hometown of Rochester.
Linda now is like a lot of native Rochesterians.
I grew up in a Kodak family. Aunts, uncles, father, brother-in-law.
Now herself even worked at Kodak. As a college kid in the late 60s, now was paid 10 bucks an hour for a summer job making sure film canisters didn't let in light. But now, more than 40 years later, she's in a Rochester area Best Buy, helping her husband pick out a new camera, and Kodak is not part of the conversation.
Unfortunately, no.
Why?
I don't think the quality of the Kodak cameras are as good as they used to be.
During holiday shopping season on Kodak's home turf, you might assume this is troubling news for the imaging giant, but according to Kodak, you'd be wrong.
We expect a very, very good fourth quarter.
That's Kodak CEO Antonio Perez. Kodak wouldn't talk to us on tape for this story, but Perez spoke on the company's investor conference call last month, saying that things are looking up.
All four of our digital growth businesses will expand in the fourth quarter.
But none of those are camera businesses. Kodak even recently sold off its image sensor division, reportedly for a couple hundred million dollars. Kodak has long been in the process of a painful transformation that's seen tens of thousands of Kodak workers in the Rochester area lose their jobs. But when Perez talks about the company's digital transformation and the new Kodak, he's talking about four growth businesses in particular, three of which serve the commercial printing industry.
They will be the nucleus of the new Kodak.
In short, Kodak is becoming a company that makes high-end printing equipment, not a consumer staple whose brand once rivaled Coca-Cola's in global ubiquity.
That's fading away by design.
Mark Kaufman is an analyst who follows Kodak for Rafferty Capital Markets. He's seen the company's stock plummet in the last year, driven by investor fears that Kodak is on its last legs. A recent move to tap a revolving credit line, the shuffling of key legal advisors, and higher-than-expected losses have sunk Kodak shares to under a dollar. But Kaufman says there is some reason for optimism.
This is an important quarter because, well, they've actually started to make some inroads in getting the cash on the balance sheet.
Kaufman expects Kodak to finish up the year in relatively decent shape. An upcoming patent sale could net the company billions. Several of Kodak's massive $3 million printing presses are coming online in Asia, and once they're up and running, they run exclusively on Kodak inks and printheads. Kaufman even says a seasonal surge in movie film and catalog printing creates an inflow of cash.
If you really think about it, who the end users are, they're more businesses than individual consumers.
But that's the one you recommend, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
which brings us back to Linda now at the Rochester area Best Buy. Of the four pillars of the new Kodak, only one, desktop inkjet printing, is consumer-oriented. While Kodak digital cameras have been relegated to the Best Buy website because of poor sales, you can get a Kodak printer at the store, but now isn't buying. She already has a printer made by Canon, but when she prints out photos at home, she does use Kodak paper.
I try to keep some loyalty there.
For NPR News, I'm Zach Seward in Rochester, New York.
These days, trends in employment are heading in two opposing directions. The private sector is slowly adding jobs, while the public sector continues to shed them. According to the federal government's most recent labor report, payrolls at private employers grew by 140,000 last month. At the same time, government agencies cut 20,000 jobs. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio visited the community of Inkster, Michigan, to find out more about the impact of public sector job loss.
Tammy Warren has lived on the same winding street in this suburb of Detroit all her life. She grew up in the house next door, and she and her family members own four tidy bungalows right in a row. But as she drives me down the block in her Ford pickup, Warren points out the casualties of the housing market collapse.
These two right down here on the right-hand side, these are vacant. These other two that are right here are rental houses. We've got another one that's vacant here. This one's been vacant for a while.
And vacant houses mean less tax revenue for the city.
City of Inkster has eliminated 38 positions. It's about 25% roughly of the workforce.
That's the city treasurer, Mark Stulderer. When I walked into City Hall to interview him, there was no one behind the information desk, and the city clerk's office was empty. The only sign of life in the lobby was the man sitting behind the cashier sign, taking payment for tax and water bills. Stulderer says about 70% of the city budget is spent on people, salaries, and benefits.
You can't automate a police department like you can an auto factory.
So this month, Inkster laid off 14 police officers. That's about 20% of the department. At a diner called Francesco's, residents like Daryl Osborne say they're troubled by the news.
The Inkster police is like our family. Like, we come to the restaurant, they make you feel safe to eat.
Osborne points to the restaurant's new security cameras, which the owner put in when news of the layoffs hit. The diner is a favorite spot for Inkster police, but with fewer officers on the force, there are fewer of them coming in for the $2.25 breakfast special. And Osborne says the restaurant isn't the only place where their absence is felt.
When I ride through the neighborhoods of Inkster, you know, used to see them out, you know, in their cars, you know, patrolling the areas and everything. And you don't see that no more due to the layoffs.
And Inkster is actually faring better than some Michigan cities. Pontiac has dismantled its entire police department, contracting the work out to the county sheriff. And the city is about to get rid of its fire department as well. Betty Buss is a municipal finance expert with the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. She says higher pension and health insurance costs have also added to the challenge.
And unless property taxes increase, which means that the value of properties increase dramatically, the situation's not going to change.
Buss says in the meantime, cities will look to revamp pension plans and collective bargaining agreements. Sharing services and even merging communities are also options for local governments looking to stay in the black. But in the end, there appear to be few good alternatives to laying off public workers. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hewlett.
Things Considered continues in a moment. When the giant trading company MF Global went belly up, more than $1 billion of its clients' money was declared missing. A lot of that money belonged to ranchers and farmers. They're big customers of MF Global, investing in futures contracts to hedge against losses in case the market for their crops or livestock goes south. Now those farmers and ranchers can't get their money back. Tim Ritzky is one of them. He's a cattle rancher in Coldwater, Kansas, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Ritzky.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So how much money of yours is tied up in this whole MF Global mess?
I had about $30,000 in my hedge account when MF Global declared bankruptcy.
Are you getting any information now from MF Global about what happened to that money or when you might be able to get access to that cash?
You get no information from MF Global whatsoever. So every evening when I come in, I just Google MF Global News and try to get all the latest information on it.
So there's no one that you can get in touch with at MF Global that can help you out with this at all?
Oh, no. If you do, you're going to get a busy signal. If you do, you're on hold until you give up, basically.
How is this affecting the way you're doing business right now? Are there things that you cannot do that you would be doing?
Well, much like a household budget, if you had $30,000 in the bank and all of a sudden that money disappeared, it would change your personal life and it changes your business life much the same. Let's say in the ranching business, you wanted to buy some replacement females or breeding stock or a pickup. Now you're not sure, what should I do? I don't want to put myself in a bind and have to borrow more money. So the uncertainty really is the worst thing. And as you know, any business hates uncertainty.
Yeah. How do you feel about investing in the futures market now?
Well, I have no confidence whatsoever in it. And I don't see how anybody could. Because basically what happened, Lynn, is that I had a segregated account with MF Global. They were the brokerage. And with the stroke of a computer key, somebody hit enter and my money went to cyberspace somewhere. And I have no confidence that that couldn't happen in any other brokerage.
Segregated account meaning this is the account that MF Global was not supposed to dip into in any way.
That's correct. And one of the selling points of using the futures market to mitigate risk was that no one had ever lost money in segregated accounts.
So is this going to change the way you run your ranch in the future? I mean, are you going to have to find a new way of doing business?
Well, sure. I think a lot of people, probably even people listening to your program today, think that, well, these people, if they're gambling, you know, it's like don't gamble with money you don't have. Well, this is just the opposite. Most people are familiar with the oil market, how it goes up and down. Well, the cattle market, grain markets do exactly the same thing. So when you find a price that you're happy with and maybe you can lock a profit in, you hedge that product through the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And to do that, you have to have a brokerage. And MF Global was the brokerage that cleared my trades. So it's not gambling. It's just the opposite.
Yeah.
We're trying to mitigate risk.
Tim, just give us a sense of the size of your ranch and, you know, what is your business like?
Of course, we're prejudiced, but we think we have a beautiful ranch. The cattle are handled just like they were a lot of years ago, all by horseback. Really, I guess if you came out here, you would think that you had gone back in time. Mm-hmm. But in our county, there are only 1,900 people. There is no stoplight. It's an hour to fast food any direction. It's an hour to Walmart in any direction. But we like that.
Do you feel that that way of life is threatened because of this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's hard to explain, but a lot of people out here still do business with a handshake. So in other words, I'm going to buy hay from somebody, and he said, okay, I'll sell you hay for $100 a ton, and you shake hands, they deliver the hay, and you write them a check. And I don't need to give them down money. I don't need to write a contract. And there's still an enormous amount of business done in our area just like that. So this is really a different part of the world. When I had a hedge account to protect my prices, I didn't want to invest in European sovereign debt. I didn't want to invest in MF Global. I had nothing to do with their business. They just stole my money. That's the bottom line. And now I have to figure out how to get it back.
That's Tim Ritzky, who raises cattle in Coldwater, Kansas. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Ritzky.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's nice to be with you. Thanks for asking me.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Packing up and making a major move is rarely easy and often a difficult decision, but many Americans are feeling desperate. A recent NPR Kaiser Family Foundation poll surveyed long-term unemployed or underemployed workers, and 40% of them said they would be willing to move out of state to find a job. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Breck Lawson was student body president at his well-regarded liberal arts college. And after graduating in 1990, he anticipated becoming part of the well-paid middle class. But over the past decade, in a series of jobs and attempts to start his own business, nothing has quite worked out. He now finds himself saddled with debt and no job in sight.
I've got a decent home. My wife is supporting us. I'm grateful for what I have, but I feel when it comes to finding a job that I could support my family, I feel, I don't know, it's not cornered, it's not hopeless. It's just, I want more. I want a way out.
So Lawson is considering a pretty radical step, moving from the Seattle suburbs to North Dakota. That state, in the midst of an energy boom, has the nation's lowest unemployment rate. Lawson, who participated in the NPR Kaiser poll, knows the checkered work history on his resume is problematic, but he thinks he'll have better luck in a place where there are more job openings and where the bar to getting hired may be lower.
You show up at the door, you get past the resume, and you're there, you're ready to work, you've sacrificed by leaving your family behind. You'll yes to any shift, to any time, to any pay, and work, you know, within reason. And I feel like in that situation, I'll shine.
The 44-year-old who'd like to work in marketing, supply chain management, or some kind of accounting, sees this as a way to get back on track. It won't be easy. He'd be away from his family and likely living in a trailer with someone else who needed a job.
The fact that these folks are willing to make these kinds of compromises tells you the kind of situation that we're in.
That's William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution. He says this sort of thing wouldn't be happening as much in a normal economic environment.
What really keeps people stable are these social and family relationships. Because picking up and moving is, you're changing your whole world. It's not just that you're changing a job, you're just changing your whole manner of existence.
While a sizable number of individuals in our survey said they would make a long-distance move to find a job, for others, moving was not an option. Take Mickey De Los Reyes. She's among the ranks of the long-term underemployed. A parapro in a school district in central Washington state, her hours have been cut from about 30 a week to just over 20.
I've been really lucky. Like I say, you know, I could have lost my job, but it's been ugly, you know, and it's scary.
De Los Reyes is a single mom in her 50s, raising five kids. They're not her biological kids, but kids who needed a home. Some of them have special needs, so moving would be especially difficult.
The resources that I have in this community for my kids are really important. Medical care here is wonderful. I wouldn't want to interrupt that.
In addition, De Los Reyes lives with her daughter and her husband, who help care for the kids. So if she moved, they'd all have to move. Other individuals don't move because they can't find jobs anywhere, or they're living rent-free with family members, or because they can't sell their house. In addition to a question about moving, individuals who've been unemployed or underemployed for more than a year were asked about other steps they would be willing to take to find a job. About 80% said they would work night and weekend shifts. Slightly more said they would take an entry-level job in a new field. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.